When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In this edition of Hoopsology, senior editor at The Ringer Howard Beck returns to the show to talk with Justin about a variety of NBA topics, including Draymond Green, LeBron James' NBA future, playoff sleepers, Wembanyama's impressive rookie year, and whether or not the NBA really has an officiating problem. Howard was a great, great guest, provided a lot of awesome insight. He was on our show about a couple of years back, so it's great to have him return to Hoopsology. Hoopsology is presented by Ballist Life. Please leave a review on iTunes and subscribe to our YouTube channel for all of our content. And now, Howard Beck.
Justin, great to see you again. Great to be back. Thanks.
Thanks for coming back onto the show. A lot of topics to discuss with you. First, I want to touch on your most recent article you did on Draymond Green. I think he's one of the most fascinating players in the NBA. Really interesting. I'm a fan of 90s basketball, so your piece touched on Ron Artest and just Dennis Rodman, some players similar to Draymond Green. And just reading through your article, I just wanted to ask, just with players that have a similar temperament to Draymond, what kind of balance does he go through in terms of keeping that vitality, keeping that intensity, but always having to balance crossing the line or not? And when he does, it having, you know, not great consequences for not only himself, but for his team. Can you kind of describe kind of what that balance is like and what he's going through now in terms of making sure he doesn't step over the line again?
Yeah. And there have been, you know, a bunch of players like this throughout NBA history, right? And they're all different, right? I don't want to draw too close of a parallel. Draymond is not Dennis Rodman. They're very different, especially off the court. Draymond is not Charles Barkley. He's not Ron Artest. But all of them, the similarity, the parallels that I was drawing within that story is just that there are some players who part of their persona on the court specifically, in Barkley's case, it sometimes bled into off the court stuff, but on the court, there's a certain ferocity and an aggressiveness and a physicality and an attitude that fuels who you are, that makes you the effective player that you are. And in the case of, you know, most of the guys we just named, Hall of Famers, right? Rodman's Hall of Famer, Barkley's Hall of Famer, Draymond will be, Artest not. But the similarity is that they all have a certain amount of physicality and aggression and again, a ferocity that powers their on-court persona, that powers their play. And they all, you know, played on the edge a little bit. And if you have been praised throughout your career and encouraged even by coaches and teammates, hey man, you got to be you. This is how you're most valuable to us on the court. Then it becomes, I think, a little bit harder to figure out where the line is, right? And so if you've crossed the line, as Artest infamously did, as Draymond has done, as Barkley did at times, as Rodman did at times, then you have to figure out, how do I harness all of this aggression and edginess that makes me so effective without letting it bleed over? And, you know, one of the things that I wrestled with in this story and that I talked to a lot of people about in writing the story is just that we talk about, like, you know, the decision a guy made in the moment, in the spur of the moment, to swing at somebody, kick somebody, do whatever. These aren't really decisions as we think about them as human beings, right? It's split second stuff that's happening. So it's an impulse control thing more than anything. So what Draymond is going through, similar to what some of the others have gone through, is yes, he's been working with therapists and working on techniques to try to not tamp down all of it, right? You don't want to lose what makes you you. And this is a physical sport, and that aggression is important for a lot of players. But trying to navigate that line, trying to maximize the best of those qualities without letting it spill over, that's the challenge that is now in front of Draymond. And you know, frankly, has been in front of him for a while now. But the, you know, once you've been hit with an indefinite suspension, a very rare thing in the NBA, it's the urgency to figure this out, to figure out how to gauge yourself. The urgency is obviously at its highest, because as Steve Kerr told me for that story, like, you know, this is his career now. Like, there's a lot more on the line having gone to the places that he's gone. And, you know, at this point, the league, you know, obviously, and anything that Draymond does is going to be so heavily scrutinized and judged that you really do have to look at this through the prism of the next offense could be the last one.
So I want to shift gears, and I'm curious about your opinion, because we've had previous guests on our show discuss officiating within the NBA this season, and they seem like they say this is not too much of a problem. And I'm wondering if you concur with that opinion. Most recently, with Rudy Gobert insinuating about betting in terms of kind of his beef with the officials as well. Do you think there's a problem with this officiating within the NBA this season? And if so, do you think there's any measures that the NBA needs to do to rectify the situation? Because I've seen that a lot of, you know, I realize Twitter is not the overall NBA audience, but if you just go off social media, there's a lot of outrage, you know, every couple of games about some major blown calls.
That's everything. That's all the time. I mean, that is Twitter in a nutshell. There's grievances just baked into it. I feel like we are also just in an era where grievance within fandom is like 40% of fandom now, right? Like, it's 60% cheering and fun, and the rest of it is just grievance. That's not the way fandom used to be in a pre-social media time. I don't know if that's because of Twitter, if that's because of just the times we live in, 24/7 debate shows, everything. I don't know, but fandom, it feels like, has changed. That's a tangent. Officiating has always been, you know, some mix of human error and, you know, superimposed beliefs, right? If you're a fan of this team and you think that ref has it in for your team, you're just always going to see it that way. Certain players and certain coaches that I've covered over the course of the last 30 years almost have at times thought a ref had it in for them. It's funny, I won't name the referee, but there was a referee who's now retired who, during his time, and he was one of the best referees in the league, I swear every single team at some point would say, this person, Joe Blow, has it in for us. Well, he can't possibly have it in for all of you simultaneously. If he's got it in for you and it's affecting the outcome of calls, it can't be that he has it in for both teams or all 30. It's just part of sports. Fans and players and coaches are always going to be upset with some calls. The question is whether those are, just typical human error. Things, you know, things happen bang, bang in this league, right? It's really quick. We see a lot more, especially now today with the technology we have, 60-inch high-def TV screens in our living rooms, and the refs don't have the advantage of that. Or we see the overhead shot. My favorite is like, oh, there's the overhead shot. Oh, you can see clearly that the ball was not in the cylinder. Well, there's no referee mounted on the top of the scoreboard, as Ronnie Nunn, the former head of officiating, once used to say years ago. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that. I think the rule of thumb in the NBA has always been about 10% of calls. You know, they make about 90% right on any given night and 10% maybe errors. The league reviews all of this to the nth degree. We know they do the last 2-minute reports that we see publicly, but they're reviewing the other 46 minutes too. We just don't see it, but the officiating staff does. The league does an incredible amount of training, an incredible amount of review. These referees spend all their waking hours, if they're not actually officiating a game, the amount of time they spend having to review their own calls, their own mistakes, points of emphasis and other things that the league is putting in front of the entire staff. Hey guys, we've been a little bit loose lately with this particular kind of call. Here's some cleanup we need to do. It's an immense amount of time spent on it. Is officiating any worse now in 2023-24 than it has been in prior seasons? I don't even know how to gauge that. All I can tell you is every couple of years, some stuff flares up. We all say there's like, it's a big crisis of officiating, where there was a summit 5 years ago between 6 years ago between the players and the refs because there was too much going on or too much tension between refs and players, and there were a lot of just incidents. To me, it's just the same as it ever was. I don't think there's any particular crisis of officiating. I will say this, just as a data point, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but over the last 10 years, we've lost a lot of veteran officials. A lot of veteran officials have aged out or been injured and had to retire. And so the refereeing staff today, I think, and I'm just guessing here, but I'd be pretty confident in this, is probably as young as it's been since I started covering the league in 1997. And I don't mean young just by age, but young in terms of NBA level experience. So having lost a lot of their institutional memory and their veteran talent, and having had a lot of new blood coming into their staff over the last, again, 5 to 10 years, I think it's fair to think that that has an impact. But again, by and large, I don't see the NBA has any big officiating crisis. The Rudy Gobert thing, and Luka's done this too with the, you know, putting up your hands, doing this, the money thing. That's on you. I'm sorry. That's on you as the player. Like, players are always going to feel like, you know, a call was made incorrectly. They got screwed, whatever. You can complain. It's never going to change a call, but you can complain. But you can't start implying that the referees are on the take. And in Rudy's case, going the extra mile and linking it to the NBA's embrace of gambling. Like, at that point, you're basically saying people are corrupt. You want to say people make mistakes? Yes, they make mistakes. You want to say the referees need to be better trained? You can do all that. You cannot run around saying that the referees are on the take or and are corrupt. That's a bit of a problem. And if you believe that, like, why are you even doing this? Like, it's, you know, and if fans believe that, why are you even rooting for this, you know, teams in this league? Why are you watching if you believe that the whole thing is somehow fixed? Like, you know, find something better to do with your time if you believe that.
Howard, you mentioned a great point about fandom, and I just want to ask you, just with the officials, you stated that they're young in terms of their experience. With this era of social media, I think the older officials didn't have to deal with that constant pressure. Do you think that has any effect in terms of how the fans are consuming the game, in terms of just the constant needling, the constant just over focus at every single blown call, at every single game? I feel like, you know, back in the 90s, 2000s, there's mail, but that to maybe get to them, or just, you know, writing just, you know, letters to newspapers, that takes time compared to just that instant feedback of just social media. Is that a challenge that you think officials of this era is facing in terms of just blocking that out and doing their jobs?
Yeah, I'm going to guess that most referees are not spending a lot of time on social media or looking at how fans are reviewing them. I know we did have the infamous incident a year ago with Eric Lewis, who ended up resigning as a referee when it was discovered that he had what we call a burner account, firing back at people. I think that's the outlier. Referees, their jobs are hard enough. Like, they hear plenty when they're in the arena and have fans screaming at them and coaches screaming at them, players screaming at them. I don't suppose that they're seeking out too much feedback from the public beyond that. And they get, as I say, plenty every day from their own superiors at the NBA. The referees, I would be hard pressed to come up with a profession that is under more scrutiny just within their own organization than referees are. They, I'm telling you, they get reviewed to the nth degree. When people say, oh, you know, a player gets a tech and they get fined, or a player screws up, they get fined, whatever. How come referees don't get punished? You have no idea, folks. Like, and then there's a referee union, right? So there's a collective bargaining agreement. There are rules for how they're disciplined or when they're disciplined and what that discipline looks like. So just because you don't hear it doesn't mean that referees don't sometimes get into trouble for just not doing the job well. And I don't mean in any kind of you know, mysterious way. It's just the typical stuff, but they are reviewed to the nth degree. That's the way the referee program goes, and way more now than 20 years ago, partially because of technology, partially because the referee program has undergone a lot of dramatic changes in the last 15 years, especially in the wake of the Tim Donaghy fiasco and that scandal. They have had to really, just create a much more stringent framework for how they employ referees, how they review referees. And so, you know, mistakes are still going to happen. But again, that's just the human element in terms of, that part of the game. And there's only so much review you can do. I wish they would do less review, frankly.
Now, if that does kind of take things up, usually it's just with the social reviews. Yeah, I totally understand that. Moving to LeBron real quick. He recently passed 40,000 points. He does have an impending contract that is looming. What are your expectations in terms of he does receive a max deal just based on what happened with Kobe? Do you think that's precedent set in terms of what LeBron will receive? Or do you think there's might be something in terms of, you know, we heard about Bronny in terms of him staying in school for another year. Is there anything in terms of him? I mean, he did say he wanted to play with his son, but do you think that'll factor into him staying in Los Angeles for a long time?
It's really hard to say. I don't know how to begin to guess at what LeBron will do after this season. He clearly wants to stick around for a while. He's still playing at an incredibly high level. There's no reason yes. for him to walk away right now. He's still one of the best 15, 20 players in the league. And he has always, you know, he's talked for years about wanting to play with Bronny. Will Bronny even make the NBA? It's an open question still. If he does, where does LeBron want to literally play with him as teammates, or is it okay just to be in the league at the same time as Bronny? Will he put the pressure on, let's say Bronny doesn't get drafted? Would LeBron then, you know, ask whichever team he's with, the Lakers or somebody else, to sign him? I tend to think LeBron's going to be back with the Lakers regardless. I don't know what the price will be. I know it's been floated out there that he wants, you know, another max deal, you know, 2 or 3 years or whatever. And yeah, like the Kobe example is interesting because at the end of Kobe's career, and it was, you know, for Kobe, it was like post Achilles too. Like yeah. Kobe wasn't playing anywhere near this level. Most guys don't at the tail end of their career. So, you know, the calculus there was spending a lot on Kobe to show him, you know, the loyalty and the appreciation for what he'd done, for his body of work and for all he had done for the Lakers. Even if you thought he wasn't going to be able to live up to the, you know, the price, even if you thought it was going to hamstring you, which it did salary cap wise, that's a trade-off the Lakers were clearly willing to make. In this case, it's not as big of a trade-off because LeBron's still playing at an incredibly high level. That may not last through the course of another 3-year, $150 million deal or something, given his age. But, you know, I don't know if the Kobe thing is a precedent per se, but it did show the values of the Lakers, which is if you have done a lot for us, you know, we are willing to compromise a little bit of our flexibility in order to do right by you. And we also think it's just what's right to do. We also think it's the right message to send to other stars in the league who we might want to have join us in the future. But it is a quandary. It is a quandary. You are rolling the dice when a guy is, you know, late 30s and moving into his 40s and making max money. Like that's dicey. There's no way around that. And there's also, you know, it's been up and down between LeBron and the Lakers over the last few years. Some of the decisions that have been made and some of the rosters they've put around him, they've certainly been all over the map. And they're not even good enough now. I mean, I don't know too many people who consider them legit contenders this spring either. Who knows what may happen, but you know, I think he'll probably be back with the Lakers. I think it will probably be at a pretty high number. But I wouldn't rule out anything.
Shifting gears, remaining into Western Conference, wanted to ask you about Victor Wembanyama having an incredible year. What are your overall thoughts on him? It seems like he's going to win the Rookie of the Year award. Maybe later MVP, but right now just remaining in the Rookie of the Year race. What are your thoughts on just him? I know Chet Holmgren has also had a great year as well. Has he lived up to your expectations? And just mentioning LeBron, kind of that comparison, I really like two different players, but yet the hype somewhat similar. LeBron, you know, way more hype in high school. I believe he had way more expectations compared to Victor, but just with Wembanyama really, you know, living up to those expectations now, how has he appeared to you in terms of what you've seen on him on the court?
I mean, Wembanyama has lived up to every ounce of the hype. And that hype at times was, I think, a little out of control, to be honest, and then maybe not completely fair to the player. I think we should be, as the media, a little bit more judicious sometimes with the way we talk about prospects coming in and the expectations for them. All that said, and I know, look, the Spurs, the record is what it is, but that roster is also what it is. Like, it's nobody was going to turn that team into a playoff team overnight. The Spurs have a lot of work to do. I'll be absolutely fascinated to see what they do in the offseason, how much they can change in one summer. You know, there's only so much you can do in a salary cap league. They're a smaller market team. You know, does anybody want to go there to play with Victor? And when I say anybody, I mean all stars. You know, would somebody go there because they want to play with him? And if that's not the case, you know, how many trades are, you know, do you need to make this an actual respectable playoff team? Because the second they become a playoff team, you mentioned MVP, you know, yeah, you were getting a little ahead of yourself with the MVP as opposed to Rookie of the Year. He will be Rookie of the Year, possibly unanimously. But he's going to be in the MVP discussion as soon as next year, if they have even some semblance of a decent team around him. Like, he's that great. He will be in the MVP discussion very, very quickly. But you do have to be on a respectable team and on a playoff team, obviously. So I think he's been outstanding. He's been absolutely incredible. And he's also just got, there's a great combination there where he is incredibly confident, but incredibly humble at the same time. Like, the way he speaks about himself off the court, and the way he speaks about the game, and the way he values winning, and the way that he can just fill up the box score and everybody's raving about it afterward, and he's still saying, yeah, but we lost, you know, like, he's about the right things. And you knew that coming in. Everything that had been written about him, everything that you'd heard about him, he has great values. And that's ultimately why he's going to be a great success, because no one has to teach him how to be a mature player who's going to be team first, despite his superstar talents, right? He's involving his teammates. One of the things that's increased over the course of the season, or one of the things he's gotten better at, is just simple playmaking and passing. His assist numbers have gone up. He's learning how to leverage his gravity and all the attention he draws and all of his skills and his length to better his teammates. And if he had, again, more talented teammates, that would be even more clear. And that he's doing this all at such a young age is you know, absolutely incredible. Like, he's amazing. He's must see TV. And it's great that Chet Holmgren has come along at the same time, because while they're ultimately different, they are both 7 foot somethings who can do a ton of different things with the ball in their hands, who have range, who can shoot, who can, you know, block shots and seemingly be, you know, 10 places at once on the court. And there's just a natural rivalry that's going to emerge between them. And I think it's kind of already emerging, and it's going to be a lot of fun to watch them go against each other in the years to come.
One final question. I want to get your kind of early playoff preview. There's a lot of new teams in the mix, both in the Western and Eastern Conference. But yeah, I think a lot of consensus is that the Nuggets and Celtics are probably kind of leading the pack. Do you think any of these teams that are newer to the playoff picture, such as, you know, the Timberwolves, the Cavaliers, the Thunder, do you think they pose any threat to you making some noise in terms of a deep playoff run? Or do you think kind of what we'll see in terms of Milwaukee, even though the Heat, they bounce around in the standings, they're always going to be a factor. A lot of the more veteran playoff teams, they're going to kind of separate themselves from the teams that are performing better in the regular season, you think?
So I'll hit the East first real quick. Once you get past Boston, like, there are so many teams that can make a case to go to the conference finals, right? If you can avoid that 4-5 slot, where in the second round you're going to face Boston as the likely winner of the 1-8, if you can avoid Boston, you can make a case for Cleveland going to the conference finals, the Knicks going to the conference finals, the Heat going to the conference finals, the Bucks, obviously, the Sixers if Embiid is back, right? Like, there's one of the big X factors for the postseason in the East. When is Joel Embiid coming back, and what does he look like when he gets back, and does he have enough time to get back up to speed? Yeah. Because he turns them into a contender again just by walking back into the gym. So, yeah, I don't rule out any of those teams. You mentioned Cleveland by name, and you know, they were first round out last year against the Knicks. The Cavs are better now than they were last season, but so are the Knicks. I could see any of those teams making a run. When you say a deep run, all those teams that I mentioned could make a deep run. The West is interesting because, you know, now I can't remember as of today. I think Denver might now have like a half game lead or whatever, but we've had Oklahoma and Minnesota occupying the top two spots for long stretches of this season. And they're both really young, right? The Thunder have never made the playoffs with this group. The Timberwolves have made the playoffs with some of these guys, but they've never won a series. And in both cases, we're running up against one of my favorite NBA axioms, which is youth doesn't win. And when I say it doesn't win at the highest level. It usually is vulnerable in the playoffs against more experienced teams. Both these teams have a lot of talent and depth, which could offset that. But I still am kind of the belief, like I lean experience. And I think the most fascinating first round we could have in the West is if the Thunder and Minnesota do end up with the top two seeds in whatever order, and the Lakers and Warriors end up getting seventh and eighth in whatever order, because it is one of those ultimate tests of, you know, youth versus experience, where the Wolves and the Thunder clearly are better overall teams right now this season and have more depth and just a greater abundance, I think, of talent 1 through 7 or 8 than the Lakers or Warriors. But if you're a young team, do you want to see Steph Curry and Draymond Green in the first round? Do you want to see LeBron and Anthony Davis in the first round?
That's true.
Like I still think that stuff matters. And I think the experience in high pressure situations with the spotlight at its brightest, I think that matters. I'm not predicting that we have a couple of upsets with the Warriors and Lakers knocking out the Thunder and Wolves in the first round, but I'm not saying it wouldn't happen either.
No, I agree. It's going to be very interesting to see that, you know, the momentum of the regular season versus, like you were saying, just the inexperience in the playoffs, because that's a very high pressure situation. It's different. It just everything's different in terms of the pressure, just in terms of how you manage just a 7-game series compared to the regular season. So it's going to be very awesome to see what happens. Howard, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you please let our audience know where they can find you on social media and then any of the other projects you're working on as well?
Yeah, no, appreciate it. You can always find me on the site that I still will call Twitter forever, at Howard Beck. Instagram is at Howard A. Beck. I don't post there quite as often, although I've been trying to get more of my Ringer content up there. You can find all my work at theringer.com, and you can hear me every Monday on the Real Ones podcast on the Ringer Podcast Network with Logan Murdoch and Raja Bell.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Howard, again. Much appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Hoopsology, presented by Boss Life. If you have comments or questions about this episode, please email hoopsologypod@gmail.com. Also, leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on all social media platforms.